Radio Prague News. The Deputy Prime Minister Martin Jahn has announced he will quit politics at the end of the year. Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has discussed labour movement restrictions with the French President Jacques Chirac. And the Polish petrochemical company Pekka and Orlen has agreed to pay an additional 1.6 billion crowns for the Czech government's stake in the Czech chemical group Unipetrol. Czech Deputy Prime Minister Martin Jahn said on Monday he would step down at the end of the year and quit politics just 6 months ahead of the country's general elections. Mr. Jahn, in charge of economic affairs in the cabinet, had been due to head the Social Democrats' list of candidates in Prague, although he himself is not a party member. Commentators say Mr. Jahn's move was motivated by a shift further to the left by the Social Democrats, shown by a more frequent cooperation with the little reformed Communist Party in parliament in recent months. Mr. Jahn denied this on Monday at a joint news conference with Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek, who ruled out direct cooperation with the communists. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has confirmed he's been holding talks with former diplomat and European Commissioner Pavel Telička regarding the replacement of the outgoing Deputy Prime Minister Martin Jahn. Mr. Paroubek said Pavel Telička could also head the Social Democrats' list of candidates in the Prague constituency. The Czech and French governments will try and find a compromise solution to the issue of restricted labour movement. After meeting French President Jacques Chirac in Paris on Monday, the Czech Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek said he could envisage a certain liberalisation of employment restrictions, for example for Czech university graduates. France, along with the majority of old EU members, imposed temporary labour movement restrictions for citizens of new EU countries. The Polish petrochemical company Pekka and Orlen has agreed to pay an additional 1.6 billion crowns for the Czech government's stake in the Czech chemical group Unipetrol it bought earlier this year. This will make the amount Pekka and Orlen has paid for the share in Unipetrol almost 14.7 billion crowns, or $595 million. The amount was calculated by a recent audit at Unipetrol. Meanwhile, Czech police have shelved former Prime Minister Stanislav Gross's slander complaint against Polish lobbyist Jacek Spira, the state attorney's office that monitored the investigation said. He added that the police concluded that no crime had been committed. Mr. Gross filed the complaint against Mrs. Spira following his statement made at a secret meeting with the former head of the Prime Minister's office, which was secretly recorded by TV Nova. At the meeting, Mr. Gross's name was mentioned in connection with corruption during the sale of the Czech oil group Unipetrol to the Polish Pekka and Orlen company. The Czech Republic will send another military plane carrying two doctors, a rescue group and 12 tons of supplies, including tents and camp beds for Pakistan on Tuesday, the Interior Ministry said. The group will partly replace and partly reinforce a 23-member Czech medical team that has been operating in the areas hit by a devastating earthquake for several days. The reinforced medical team will remain in the town of Rawalkot in northern Pakistan for another fortnight. And finally, a glance at the weather. We can expect partly cloudy skies and daytime temperatures to range from 13 to 16 degrees Celsius in the coming days. I'm Pavla Horáková, that's the news.
I'm Dita Siedu, you're listening to Radio Prague's English service, and today the Prime Minister searches for a fresh face to win voters in Prague. Czechs determine how internet users differ from those who don't go online. And we'll hear from an ornithologist about the fascinating life of black storks. Social Democrat Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek continues to search for a replacement for outgoing Deputy Prime Minister Martin Jahn, who announced his departure from politics on Monday. Prime Minister Paroubek wanted the popular, unaffiliated Mr. Jahn to stand in Prague at next year's general election. One name being bandied about is that of Pavel Telička, the former EU commissioner. Rob Cameron has more.
Mr. Paroubek has his work cut out. The Czech Republic goes to the polls next June, and the Prime Minister must find someone to lead the Social Democrats into battle in Prague, traditionally a bastion of the right. Mr. Jahn was an ideal candidate, young, capable, popular, photogenic, and economically liberal. But Mr. Jahn is reportedly unhappy with the Prime Minister's cozying up to the communists and is leaving politics to relaunch his professional career. Now Mr. Paróbek must look elsewhere. The Prime Minister confirmed on Monday that he was in talks with Pavel Tylichka, formerly the country's EU Commissioner. In 2004, after just a few months as Commissioner, Mr. Tylichka was unceremoniously shoved aside to find a job for former Prime Minister Vladimir Špidla. But he's still remembered for his diligence in preparing the country for EU membership and respected for his expertise in EU affairs. Mr. Tylichka currently heads his own private consultancy firm with offices in Prague and Brussels. But whether he actually wants the job of Deputy Prime Minister is another matter. His ejection from the EU Commissioner's post last year can't have endeared him to the Social Democrats. Analysts are asking whether he really wants to serve as window dressing for a socialist party desperate to attract young, economically liberal and urban voters. His pre-1989 membership of the Communist Party is also anathema to the coalition Christian Democrats. Pavel Tylichka may decide private consultancy in Brussels is a more fulfilling and more fruitful career than the rough and tumble of politics.
Rob Cameron there. The Czech Republic this year is for the first time taking part in the World Internet Project, a cross-cultural survey that seeks to identify how the behaviour and views of internet users differs from those who rarely, if ever, go online. Brian Kennedy caught up with the Czech Republic project coordinator and has this report.
Much of what we know about global internet use, for example, that on average men spend more time online than women, was first quantified by the UCLA World Internet Project. The study is also the first to comprehensively track shifts in a wide range of behavior, attitudes, values, and perceptions of the internet generation. Dr. David Schmahel is a professor at the Faculty of Social Sciences at Masaryk University in Brno.
This research is carried out already in 16 or 17 countries, and we just started in the Czech Republic this year. We got the money from Czech Ministry of Education for this international cooperation, and the methodology is the same or very similar for the whole world. It's the main idea of the project that it's the same and we can compare the data from every state.
Dr. Schmahel says the data collected thus far have confirmed the global generation gap among internet users. Nearly 90% of Czech teenagers regularly use the internet, while only 15% of those in their 60s or older ever go online.
I think that the main funding of this project is that 50% of Czechs are using the internet, and is very dependent on the age of population.
The data have not yet been fully analyzed, but some preliminary findings from the survey will be published this Wednesday on the website www.technet.cz. A full report should be ready by November 7th, in time for the Cyberspace 2005 conference to be held in Brno this year. Dr. Schmahel of Masaryk University says he was especially interested to learn how young people use the internet to explore their identity and discuss sensitive topics.
It surprised me a lot that young people prefer virtual communication much more than older. And there was a really big difference how they perceive what the virtual communication brings them. The adolescent says that they release emotion much easier in the internet. For example, they use the internet quite often to communicate about sexual issues because it's not so easy to communicate on this theme in the real life. They perhaps have opportunities to explore their identity, and the internet helps them a lot in this task.
David Schmahel from the Masaryk University in Brno, ending that report by Brian Kennedy on the World Internet Project. It's been more than 3 years since massive floods wreaked havoc in Prague. Although all the visible marks have been cleaned up and repaired in the city, the restoration work is far from finished. There's still tons and tons of paper documents from flooded archives waiting in refrigeration plants. In Czech Science Today, Pavla Horáková takes us to one of the drying and rescue centers.
The sound of an air dryer in a small building in the courtyard of Prague's National Technical Museum. During the 2002 flood, some 200 cubic meters of documents were rescued from the museum's archives. Just as they were, soaked in muddy water, the documents were tied up in plastic bags and rushed to refrigeration plants before the water and mold could start their work of destruction. Kateřina Šupová is the head of the Technical Museum's drying laboratory.
Our center is unique in the amount of documents we're dealing with. In other countries, it is usually small accidents, 10 books or so, that get soaked and have to be rescued. But here, we're talking of dozens of cubic meters of documents. The scale on which we're working is unparalleled in Europe.
Paper, paper everywhere. Technical drawings, plans and sketches. The Technical Museum's archive housed, for example, all the plans for Prague's National Theatre and the complete technical documentation of the Prague Metro. The team have fine-tuned two methods for drying small and large format documents using quite unsophisticated instruments, often ordinary kitchen appliances. Once taken out of the freezer, the large scrolls are put in tubs to defrost. They are cleaned with a sponge, sprayed with disinfectant, and then interlaid with filter paper and unwoven fabric. When the pile, or sandwich as they call it here, is some 20 centimeters tall, it is weighed down and pressed. A4 size documents are again interlaid with filter paper and unwoven fabric, but between the layers, ordinary newspapers are placed. The sandwich is put in a plastic bag and the air is sucked out from it in an ordinary vacuum packer. The vacuum-packed paper sandwich is left for 2 weeks, during which the newspapers absorb much of the dampness. The procedure is repeated 3 times and then the sheets are left to dry naturally. And, unbelievably, they look like new. Finally, all the documents are sent to special laboratories to remove all mildew spores and for expert restoration if they need it. The Technical Museum's drying center is one of many such establishments in the Czech Republic. With some 20 cubic meters of documents defrosted and dried every year, the 6-member team at the museum have enough work until the year 2013.
Czech Science was brought to you by Pavla Horáková. Prague Castle dominates the skyline of the Czech capital and is one of the most potent symbols of this country's culture and history. A new exhibition at the castle features haunting and intriguing photographs of the former seat of Czech kings, from the days when the art of photography was very much in its infancy. Ian Willoughby reports from the exhibition.
It's a sunny but breezy October afternoon here at Prague Castle, where hundreds, possibly thousands of foreign tourists have come to watch the changing of the guard. But the castle looked very different when the first photographs were taken here 149 years ago.
Máme ty tři pozující postavy, které pochopitelně práci...
Pavel Schiffler is the man behind the exhibition.
Nejstarší fotografie na výstavě je dílo Andrease...
This is the oldest known photograph of Prague Castle. It dates from 1856. It was taken by a Viennese photographer called Andreas Groll on his first visit to Prague.
To byla jeho první návštěva v Praze.
Many of the photos are taken from below and from the banks of the river Vltava. They bring to mind the dark, forbidding castle of the author Franz Kafka.
No, on přímo žil, že jo, ve Zlaté uličce na Pražském hradě, ale to je...
Kafka actually lived for a while up here at the castle, in Golden Lane. But many of these photographs here are actually from before his time. He was born in the 1880s, so he didn't know the castle in its really ancient form. It was changing in his day. For instance, the towers of St. Vitus Cathedral date from 1892.
And the famous cathedral dominates the exhibition, in the same way it dominates Hradčany, the castle district.
Pro mnoho lidí bude určitě fascinující fakt, že krov chrámu svatého Vítězství.
Many people will be fascinated to learn that the frame of the roof of St. Vitus Cathedral is actually made of metal. We have some great pictures here of the completion of the roof. This one shows workers who have clearly been posed by the photographer. It looks almost modern and avant-garde.
But there are very few people in these photographs,
taken between 1856 and 1900. Pavel Schiffler explains why.
Je třeba si uvědomit, že ta fotografie 19. století byla jiná než ta fotografie století 20.
19th century photography is different from 20th century photography. Many of these pictures were taken using the complicated wet collodion process, in which exposure took a few seconds. So there are very few people, or even clouds. There are exceptions. In this photo, for instance, there are posed figures who are really clear. But this figure here is transparent because the person walked in front of the camera during exposure.
And the exhibition is on at Prague Castle until the middle of January.
You're listening to Radio Prague, and now in One-on-One, Jan Wellinger talks to an ornithologist who's been tracking the curious life of black storks.
In today's One-on-One, my guest is ornithologist Lubomir Peschke, who has been involved at practically every stage of the Odyssey Projects, a series of tracking expeditions supported strongly by Czech radio and greeted enthusiastically by listeners that uses satellite to monitor the lives of black storks. These days, projects include New Odyssey, tracking specimens traveling south from Mongolia to winter. But in this interview, we discussed the project's first inception, African Odyssey, which tracked birds flying from the Czech Republic to countries in Africa. That was the first time anyone had attempted to track black storks by satellite for a longer period of time. Lubomir Peschke, One-on-One.
10 years ago, when we started with the African Odyssey, it was very little known about bird migration. Of course, there were results from ringing recoveries, and for black storks we had only few recoveries from Africa. And it was the time when satellite tracking was already known, but not very frequently used. There were only few ornithological projects using satellite telemetry. And in that time, we decided that it's a really good tool to know much more, not only where these birds are flying, but also what is the landscape there, what is the threat for them, what is the problem, what is the competition. And that's why we decided to follow black storks during their migration to Africa. There were some limits, of course. The first one was that this bird should be big enough to carry this extra load, because in that time the smallest satellite transmitters were only 70 grams.
How did you come in as a zoologist?
At the beginning, there were talks about three friends. Their background was zoology, ornithology. And the main problem was, is it technically possible? Finally, we found some sponsors. Czech radio was one of the main actors. It was a very great idea of Mirabel Beck that we should give names to storks, and if we will follow a fate, a history of one particular bird, this bird can become friend for many children and also friend for us.
One of the storks in the first group was called Christina, and I understand that she was the first bird monitored ever for a longer period with that kind of satellite monitoring device.
It's true. In that time, all satellite transmitters were charged by batteries. The lifespan of these transmitters was, in general, 1 or 2 years. So what was necessary, it was to catch after 1 year, when the bird has returned back to breeding area, catch it again and replace the transmitter. And fortunately, we were able to catch Christina again, because at the beginning we had three birds. All of them reached winter grounds in Africa. All of them returned back home. Christina became famous not in the first year, but because we were able to catch her again, because after return she was breeding. We caught her again next year, so we could follow her for almost 4 years. Christina was from Central Bohemia. Viktor was from Rakovník area in western part of Czech Republic, and Zuzana was from northwest.
Where did Christina choose to go in Africa, and what do you know about her adventures?
Well, of course, big stork is quite different species, quite different behavior, and they fly single or in very small groups. And what we found, and what was quite surprising, we clearly proved that Christina flew to Africa using different ways. Once she crossed Pyrenees Mountains east, next year west. So she followed different trajectories over Sahara, different routes, but she always ended in the same water body in eastern Senegal. And this is place where we found her in the first year. We followed her by cars, almost step by step, day by day, almost 2 months in expedition following her. And at the beginning of expedition, we didn't know where we go, of course. In general, we knew that black storks are wintering south of Sahara. Mm-hmm. But when we were preparing our expedition, we had visa for Senegal, Mali, Mauritania, and different countries. And we crossed Sahara, and we found her in eastern Senegal near Faleme River. And there is a very nice village, Jakaling, without electricity, without anything. We reached this Jakaling by foot because there was no road for cars. And Christina was wintering in this area. And next year or next winter, she was always returning to the same place. So it is clear that some species like black storks, they know one place, it is breeding site, just a very small area in Europe. And for wintering, they know another very small restricted area in Africa somewhere. Christina,
it's amazing,
knew eastern Senegal. And we know from other birds that they, for example, like Zuzana, she was always wintering in central Ethiopia. Where will be the wintering area? It is a result of, let's say, more or less random way in the first year.
And then they repeat it.
And they, after that, they know it and they repeat it again and again.
Here we are talking about the stork surviving.
Yeah.
It must have been an adventure just for those of you on the ground to survive as well, because here you were crossing, as you say, the Sahara.
Yeah, well, this was certainly a good adventure. It was, you know, in the year 95, new situation for all people in our country, and we discovered these areas for us, because not too many people visited these areas. And especially what I can say and what I appreciate, these black storks, it was not only Senegal, we were in Ethiopia and Chad, in other African countries. These black storks showed us remaining places or corners in Africa where we could see something what is quickly disappearing,
mm-hmm.
you know, nature and also local tribes that are living in Iron Age, with very, very rural condition. Africa is changing quite quickly, deforestation, overpopulation. It's changing the nature in Africa. So it's not very easy. Even if you have general information from satellites that bird should be in this area, and even if you use this conventional telemetry, so you are looking for the signal by antenna, it's not clear that you will find the bird. So I was always satisfied when we had a problem, when we had, for example, days without signal, and finally we found the bird. I feel very happy in Chad, because we had really problems in traveling in Chad, because there are no roads. And finally, we were slowly approaching to the place where we expected our bird, and we had a signal.
And we've reached the end of this Radio Prague program. Thanks for joining us today, and be sure to tune in for more from Radio Prague soon. For a review of our older programs, visit our website at www.radio.cz, where you'll find most of our reports transcribed and available in sound. For more information about Radio Prague, you can also send us an email to english@radio.cz, or if you prefer snail mail, our address is 12099 Prague 2 in the Czech Republic. My name's Zita Asiedu. Thanks for joining us. Goodbye.